This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and my guest today is podcaster Mike Pesca, who publishes The Gist podcast every weekday. The Gist is 30 minutes of smart, engaged interviews with really interesting, often controversial people, and it includes Mike's own sensible and fact-driven analysis of the news. I listen to it most days of the week. I highly recommend it. He's a veteran of NPR and Slate, and perhaps unsurprisingly, he's a leading critic of legacy media, especially its willingness to overthrow long-standing commitments to objectivity and fairness in pursuit of progressive versions of moral clarity. We talk about his controversial 2021 separation from Slate after he defended a New York Times reporter's use of the N-word in a Slack channel at Slate. This is a story that you don't want to miss. It says so much about where media is these days, or media are these days. We also talk about why so many newspapers are failing and whether media gatekeeping had any real value back in the day. Mike thinks of it more highly than I do, to be quite honest. In any case, this is a great conversation, and it is The Reason Interview with Mike Pesca. This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thank you all for coming out. Our guest today is Mike Pesca, a multi-generational, a multi-decadal journalist who is also the host of The Gist, which you say is the longest running daily news show. By
news
a guy
analysis.
Named Mike Pesca.
Right, right.
In history, right?
By half Italian, half Jew.
Okay. Right, yeah. Poof. You know, that's like, that's a spicy meatball right there, huh? When did you start The Gist?
The Gist was started in 2014. Mm-hmm. We've been, so news and analysis, there are podcasts that are taking a radio show and putting it in podcast form. And there are other podcasts, but that have been going on longer than I, but every day, talking yep. about the news, giving you the news, but analyzing the news. I think we're the longest. Yeah. And, if anyone else can rebut that, let them come, and we will fight it out in the Thunderdome, I say.
Before you were doing The Gist, you were at NPR, right?
For 10 years, I was at NPR. Yeah. I was a sports correspondent for about 7 of those years. Then I was with Slate and The Gist, and before NPR, so I'm jumping around a little, I was with a show called On the Media, which is from WNYC and an NPR show.
All right. And what was it like being the sports guy at NPR?
It's like being
I broke a fingernail playing chess, right? I mean, this is what?
It was like being the opera correspondent at ESPN. Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Very nice.
It was good. I loved it because I figured out how to do it that would appeal to an NPR audience, but also people who actually know sports. So I think a lot of people would report for NPR, and all they would do is one of two things, just dumb it down, or very much emphasize the personal angle, human beings, and that's fine. But a lot of the NPR sports coverage wound up sounding like Olympics coverage, where everyone overcame cancer or overcame iron poor
Everybody's parents were driving them in the dark to the baseball batting cage.
Everyone's
or the skating
stepdads
rink
and the audience blind. And so what I did, this is not that in-depth analogies. That's my secret sauce. I just made analogies so as to suck in the non-sports loving audience.
Right. Did you ever use Sophie's Choice as an analogy?
I might have in between Ryan Leaf or Peyton Manning, there's a Sophie's Choice. We know which one should go. I remember talking about, I was at the World Series between Boston, the Red Sox, one of the Boston World Series. Oh, and St. Louis. And a pitcher named Michael Wacha, was on the mound for St. Louis. And the Boston crowd would chant in their accents. Now, a lot of people know that Boston accents, you have the A, Pak Ya Ka, but they also have the opposite of it. When the name ends in the A, they put an R there. So the entire crowd was chanting, Walker, Walker. And so I don't know, I didn't exactly analogize it, but I talked about linguistically what that is called, and the NPR audience loved it.
And you like the Red Sox because you grew up on Long Island and you're a Mets fan, right? And the Red Sox couldn't beat the Mets when they needed to, right?
They were very beneficent.
How did you get into radio and kind of talking? Because you also do a lot of writing. You have a great Substack that I highly recommend to anybody. But how did you end up in radio and at a place like NPR?
It's so interesting you should ask. As a 10-year-old, I would call to local station WGBB, and they had a Jets show. And as a 10-year-old, I would call in to Wesley Walker. Oh, no, it was Greg Buttle and a local sports host named Craig Muster. And they would talk Jets football. And then they'd have a 10-year-old calling with his analysis of what happened during the game. And it became sort of a big thing.
That was you.
Yes. And then... yes,
as a 10-year-old, were better at analyzing the Jets than adults were, or the Jets front office, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I knew, you should actually gain first downs, for instance, and that Richard Todd wasn't a good quarterback. So they would anticipate my calls, and I got a little hit of adrenaline for all the excitement when I would call the local Jets radio show, and I wanted to be in radio. This has always been my favorite medium.
Earlier this year, when the Free Press ran the Uri Berliner tell-all about NPR. You wrote about that and you've talked about it. What went wrong at NPR?
Well, I do think that...
Other than, letting you leave.
Yes.
Obviously. That was their first mistake.
Right, not throwing scads of money at me to keep me from ankling. I think that mostly the biggest explanation has to do with just the changing ways we consume media, and NPR is more of an old legacy media, and they rely on broadcast towers. And that's all true. But I do think their programming, and I've argued this, became less and less appealing to the NPR audience. So John Lansing, who was the CEO there, just died very sadly. And he had a North Star, which was diversity. And diversity is laudable. But if it is your number one goal, then by definition, secondary and tertiary goals have to be things like interesting programming for the audience. And it clearly became much less interesting for the audience. And friends of mine who work at NPR just said a directive went out to emphasize we are trying now, NPR is trying now to appeal to 40 to 65-year-olds. In other words, the NPR audience. So I think they got so involved, not just in the diversity of the workforce, but in presenting opinions that were not inviting. I don't think the NPR listener is necessarily going to say, how dare you, and turn off the radio. But if you keep tuning in and they keep using language that you don't relate to and talking about stories that don't really meet you where you live or strongly imply, if not say, that you, their listener, is a bad person for just the things you think, I think it's going to be off-putting. And they're in a crisis now, and I think they did over-index for that kind of program.
So they were pursuing, kind of diversity or wokeness as the number one, and their audience is not particularly diverse.
Their audience is older. It happens to be whiter, but mostly as a function of the older audience being whiter. I just think that we age into NPR as we, are assigned to Volvo in the suburbs or whatever. But I think that by actively striking out against their audience, they did not do themselves any favors.
This is a news flash, right? That if you tell your audience they suck, they're not going to be your audience that much longer.
Yeah, 2 or 3 hours a day of feeling guilty is great. But once it hits four or five, you're going to tune
out. That's a lot. You're not carrying that around in a tote bag, right?
Yeah.
I will just throw this out because obviously he was purged for a while, but then was brought back. But Prairie Home Companion, when I would drive my kids around, I would always threaten them if they acted up in the car. If you don't stop doing that, I'm going to turn Prairie Home Companion on, which was on all the time because I was in rural Ohio, and between Cincinnati, Columbus, and Dayton, Ohio, there were like 6 NPR stations, and one of them was always playing Prairie Home Companion, and the kids would be angels.
Yeah. Okay, so there is an opposite to you can do too much to assuage and pet the sensibilities of kind of boring white people. That is true also.
So you moved on from Slate, and then we're going to talk more about The Gist and more about kind of current news issues. Well, I guess before we go to Slate, you know, let's talk a little bit about legacy media, because NPR, you know, has been around for a long time. It has a massive audience. It's got the best distribution of any radio channel, right? Because it's multiple places all over the place, right? Why isn't that like delivering a captive audience anymore, do you think?
Right. So the radio part of it is just because we have gotten away from radio, and the knee-jerk explanation would be, well, you know, we're not in a radio world. What are we in? We're in a podcasting world. And there was a time, just 5 to 10 years ago, where NPR dominated the list of the best podcasts or the most listened to podcasts. And so I'm not going to say they did anything wrong by allowing The Daily to be such a dominant show, but The Daily is doing
This is the New York Times daily news podcast.
Right. So The Daily does, by taking a lot of NPR talent, which means they hired away more talented people who NPR always thought didn't have any other place to go, so we don't have to throw a lot of money at them or throw a lot of new opportunities at them. And so The Daily really showed NPR, oh my gosh, they started eating NPR's lunch, and they showed NPR what can be done. Now, a lot of the top ranked shows are NPR newscasts and NPR Now, but more and more shows that were in NPR became more and more popular. And we could go over the list of extremely popular, well-listened to shows that NPR just frittered away, that were in their ambit.
Give an example.
Freakonomics, right? Okay. That was not an NPR. That was a WNYC show. Right. I don't know why they didn't retain them.
WNYC is a public radio station based in New York.
Right.
You work there. That's where On the Media is based. It's one of the big incubators of talent and programming.
But not... though an incubator of talent, not one to hold on to talent. Another show is Shankar Vedantam's The Hidden Brain. So there are many, many shows that right now are in the top 20 with NPR people, even that were NPR public radio shows, but they did not make the right decisions. And I think they probably thought, hey, we have all these broadcast networks. We don't really have to be that aggressive. We don't have to sign good people. We don't have to retain good people. Where there's this mindset, where else are they going to go? We're NPR. We're the only game in town. Now they're not.
Starting to sound like the Jets, right? Where it's like, hey, we're in the biggest city in the country. You know, where are people going to go?
In this analogy, PBS is the Giants and is one too soon. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, no. Yeah. But it is hard to be a Jets fan.
Oh, it's more than hard. I guess we're supposed to say it's character building, but
right?
It's not. No.
Okay, so you go to Slate. What's interesting is Slate was one of the first online, you know, magazines, and they make a big stink about that. Independent journalism, originally funded by Microsoft.
Yeah.
And then, you know, increasingly sold off because nobody could make money doing it. What was it like working at Slate?
At the beginning, I loved it, and it was the kind of place that actively try to cultivate diversity of opinions and people arguing. And there's this whole concept of the Slate pitch, which was something that would be counterintuitive and it fit
Actually, Churchill is the villain of World War One, of World War II.
That would be the crazy way to think about it.
Right?
Yeah. I guess that's what the Slate pitch has become. Yeah.
But Slate, which was the original editor, longtime editor, was Michael Kinsley, and his whole stock and trade was, we're going to bring in a lot of different people who disagree. And they did a lot of innovative stuff online.
Hitchens wrote for Slate, and Ryan Salam wrote for Slate. And then after Kinsley, Jacob Weisberg very much had that mindset. And so did David Plotz, and so did Julia Turner, and great editors.
And so did Nick Gillespie.
Yeah.
Not regularly, but every
once
in a while.
They would reach out, and that's exactly what they wanted. It was this intellectual playground. Yeah. I fit in, I was valued. And then things changed.
Let's talk about what changed, because you... When were you fired, or did you get fired or technically resign from Slate?
I think neither technically. Okay. There are a lot of technicalities.
You just stopped answering the calls, right?
There are. Yeah. Well, as the paycheck stopped coming, I felt less inclined to answer the calls.
Yeah.
So there are...
What year, though, did you... You started there in 2000...
I have done The Gist independently for 3 years, coming on my third year. And there was about a 10-month interregnum where what the what Slate had become, and the people who worked at Slate was very different from when I started, and which was more about debate and the exchange of ideas. And it came up in very, this wasn't non-specific. Yeah. It came up in very specific ways. And if you want to talk about that, I can. And also at the same time, because I'm skilled at this, not violate my NDA, which is no problem. So it was around the time, what I was thinking is that as the locus of the Democratic Party, let's say, changed, and as the Democratic Party maybe became more
What year are we talking about?
I think we're talking about after the election of 2016 and in 2017, much of media saw a huge change and a huge reaction, and the idea of, well, let's consider these ideas, or this verboten idea, maybe there's some value in it, or maybe our side isn't getting it right. Those, that became so much less compelling than the impetus to let us chronicle, which I think was very warranted many times, the misdeeds of the Trump administration. So that was going on. But I actually think, and I read a lot of publications that do this, you could be 100% accurate about the misdeeds of the Trump administration and not give up an inch on that. And yet at the same time, talk about ideas that aren't necessarily, you know, pre-approved or would come from the play sheet of the Democratic National Committee. Now, I'm not saying that Slate was purely a partisan arm. What I'm saying is that over time, as I think the median person in the Democratic Party moved to the left, so did much of media, and then Slate was part of that. So that's where they are politically. But in terms of just their attitude towards the exchange of ideas, that became, that began to change and curdle a bit as well. So it was very much the idea and ideal that if there's a bad idea, you rebut it with a better idea. And that really turned, that really became a disfavored way to think about bad ideas.
So what replaced that? Just don't engage those ideas?
Well, or there was that idea of if we engage, even to rebut bad ideas, we're doing this, and they invent this word platforming. Mm-hmm. And for a time, I'm like, well, maybe that's true, but I have come to believe that there's no such thing. There's no ill of platforming. Deplatforming someone, I think 100% of the time, just means shutting up someone you don't like. Now, there, sometimes I question this because when I was a political reporter in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a guy named Lyndon LaRouche. And, you know, he just wasn't platformed. The networks, if you went to North...
He seemed to have tables staffed with LaRouches outside of everything I went to.
If you went to the New Hampshire primary, this guy was everywhere. And if you were writing a fun kind of slice of life story, you would have had to have some references to LaRouche, the carnival, but you never did because they literally didn't platform
him. He often would be confused with libertarians for some reason, but he believed that the Delanos, the Queen of England, and was it the Pope were all involved?
He was an anti-papist.
An international opium trade, et cetera. I mean, and
I think,
you know, it's actually pretty convincing.
Oh, yeah.
On the face of it.
That's right. We would have been convinced had he been platformed. But the reason I bring it up is he really was deplatformed and it really worked. But this is when the media was much more manageable. And so now the number one example of someone who is effectively deplatformed is who do people bring up? Milo Yiannopoulos. That's who I'm thinking of. But when I looked into it, the real deplatforming of Yiannopoulos is just that he engaged in some sort of pro-pederasty ideals and the right turned on him. So I don't think anyone has actually been deplatformed. And I think the whole idea of deplatforming is just censorship by proxy.
But that's what started happening at Slate. You joined Slate what year?
2014.
Okay. And then towards the end of the teens, or like around 2017, 2018, not only the external culture, like what they were publishing or how they were talking about stuff, but internally.
Yeah.
And you got into trouble after Donald McNeil, the New York Times science reporter, was canceled for having talked about rap lyrics and using the N-word on a trip.
I don't even think it was about rap lyrics.
I don't know. Yeah, whatever.
Very torturous story, but a kid, and he was supposed to interact with high school kids, asked him a question, and he wanted clarity, and he used that actual word to gain clarity, the use of that word.
Like, you mean this.
Yes. Years later, his career, and this is a guy who's about to win a Pulitzer at the time. It was, one of the best reporters on COVID at the time. The word we use now is canceled, but he really came in for much criticism. His career was on the line. And we had a discussion channel on Slack, which is not guilt-free in all of this. Slack is a platform. We had a discussion channel at Slate called, I think, Media News or Media Talk, and this is what we were supposed to talk about. And on Slack, I would engage in conversations in the spirit, the old ethos of once we exchange ideas, ideas can be sharpened, the things that Slate puts out into the world could become better. I had frequently gotten ideas and guests from my show by getting into, not an argument, but pushback or a debate with other Slate colleagues. So at the time, there was, I think, 100% agreement that what McNeil did was terrible. And I weighed in there because it was always defined for me as this is how we have these discussions at Slate on Slack. And it was during the pandemic, so we weren't able to interact in person. And I raised points for his side, essentially. And within a day, I think, I would never work at Slate again.
Wow. And you, in your discussion, you did not only not use the N-word, you did not signify the term N-word.
Right.
So you were just saying, like, you thought he shouldn't have gotten fired for...
Yes.
You know,
I talked about the use mentioned distinction. It's different when you use the word as a slur than when you mention it, when you quote it. I talked about John McWhorter, who would make this point. John McWhorter at the time had been doing a show for Slate for 5 or 6 years. I thought these were the sort of points that one should air or add to the conversation so it wouldn't be a runaway, a railroading of an intellectual position. I thought I was adding to the discourse. And like you said, of course not. Not only did I not use a slur, I had read stories about just the phrase the N-word as being triggering. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be accused of that. So I didn't do that. It didn't matter. It was at a time, at perhaps the worst time, right, to even attempt to engage in this sort of thing.
That I only found out about that detail listening to you a couple of months ago, I guess, on Blocked and Reported. And I was stunned when this happened. I was like, okay, this seems insane, but, you know, what are you going to do? It's Slate, and they're a bunch of nut job progressives. But then you did not use, not only did you not use the word, you did not use the signifier, the N-word.
Right.
And that's
consciously,
yeah,
by strategy.
Wow.
Yeah, so as not to get
well,
in trouble.
That didn't work, did it?
No,
it
didn't work.
So, can I ask?
Which is not to say, going back, I should have used the word.
No. And I think the real problem here is that Donald McNeil, what a grown man, went on some kind of weird junket for prep school kids in Peru.
Well, whoever could afford
it. Like, what the fuck were you thinking, buddy? Like, how could that possibly end well? Right? I mean, it's like, the best thing happens is that a bunch of banditos take you all hostage and kill you. Or
when the plane crashes,
iOS.
You're the first eaten. Yeah, exactly.
You know, no, they'll be like, you know what? He's probably a little tough. Let's start with the young,
leathery,
the suckling
McNeil jerky
plane.
Right, not as good. Yeah.
So, you know, was Slate when you were there? And, and this is, I'm trying to follow a thread that's at least kind of still connected in my mind. Was Slate losing audience? Because they, you know, if you're talking about NPR getting into its own headspace about like what they have to be doing, Slate seems, you know, Slate in 2000 was very different than Slate in 2017, 2018, you know, 2020. Were they losing audience as they became less interested in actually freely discussing ideas and having the equivalent of Christopher Hitchens and, you know, and other people on?
I can tell you this, definitely not my show. My show was performing very well. And so I think from the economic angle, it was hard for them to part with me.
Yeah.
But from the, let's say, social angle, they thought it was their only choice. Though I think everyone directly involved in that decision is no longer there.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Lumen, L-U-M-E-N, the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device that measures your metabolism through your breath. You just breathe into it first thing in the morning, and the Lumen app lets you know if you're burning fat or carbs, and it gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, workout, sleep, and even stress management. You can also breathe into it before and after workouts and meals, so you always know exactly what's going on in your body in real time. I've tried Lumen, and I've got to tell you, it's a great tool for motivation and information. It's easy, and it's fun to use. Your metabolism is your body's engine. It's how your body turns the food you eat into fuel that keeps you going. Because your metabolism is at the center of everything your body does, optimal metabolic health translates to a bunch of benefits, including easier weight management, improved energy levels, better fitness results, and better sleep. Lumen can also help women track their cycles, as well as the onset of menopause, making it easier to keep your metabolism healthy during hormonal shifts. So if you want to take the next step in improving your health, go to lumen.me/interview to get 15% off your purchase. That's lumen.me/interview. lumen.me/interview and get 15% off your purchase. And now back to the Reason interview.
So, you know, you mentioned, or we've been talking at least indirectly about the New York Times. One of the things, the New York Times, of course, is legacy media, you know, obviously different than TV or radio. At a certain point in the 21st century, the Times went from being an advertising-driven publication where the, most of the revenue was coming to the, from ads, and now it's a subscription
right
thing. It's like the biggest Substack in the world. It is a newsletter for people who want to read what it has to say.
Well, I would say it's a games app that has paper attached to it.
All right.
But I love it. Don't get me wrong.
But do you think that's, you know, is that having a, you know, Times readers are probably getting more of what they want because they don't have to put up with this false objectivity or fairness or anything like that. But is the journalism less interesting?
I think the Times has actually mostly corrected for this. And the editor of the Times wrote a piece in CJR, Columbia Journalism Review, where he couldn't, or he maybe thought strategically, he couldn't say, I believe in objectivity. But he said, I and we believe in objectivity. I think that shows up in a lot of its political reporting. I think it shows up less in its cultural reporting. But there are other publications. I mean, I read and subscribe to The LA Times, canceled the Chicago Tribune, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. And of those, I actually canceled the Inquirer. They really, really went overboard for over-indexing for, you know, an objection to objectivity. That became a very big a talking point and way of thinking in the media industry. By the simple phrase, whose objectivity, they kind of rewrote the rules of journalism. And I think to great detriment. And I think one of the reasons, I don't know your average reader would say, oh, they jettisoned objectivity, but they more or less did as an ideal. And I really think it hurt the credibility of many newspapers. I'd put the Philly Inquirer and the LA Times at the top of that list. And I think...
And the Inquirer, the Philadelphia Inquirer, I lived in Philly for a couple of years and loved reading it, as well as the Daily News, which is, you know, a junky newspaper that's great, like the way the New York Post is great. The Inquirer, during the pandemic, they had a fantastic canceling of a top editor, right?
Right.
What for what?
He wrote the headline, sin? Buildings Matter Too.
Yeah.
And so that was a sin that could not stand, and he was fired. Then they bring in an op-ed writer and a journalist named, I don't want to imply that he's not a journalist, a good credentialed journalist named Wesley Lowery. And he is a guy who has written op-eds for the New York Times against objectivity, you know, whose objectivity. And he spearheaded a vetting of the entire newspaper. And the entire newspaper said, or the people who make this decision, we have to be a newspaper for the city, which is to say, here are all the ways we've ignored the black community. And I think you see it in the pages. And I think we cannot tell if you see it in their revenue because they're now owned by a nonprofit corporation. And I think they really are not making a profit. So they're adhering to that. So I do think that that was a newspaper that used to be fun and vibrant and interesting and got much less interesting because of ideology. But I think other newspapers, I don't think the Wall Street Journal did that. I think Bloomberg is a really good outlet that I trust now. And I think the ones that I trust are either newspapers of opinion or magazines of opinion, let's say Reason, where you know where they stand and they try to be fine, they try to be fair, or newspapers that have adhered more to and think that we did make some mistakes in throwing objectivity overboard. The sad thing is there's never going to be this accounting where anyone takes ownership of those decisions. It'll just happen. And the LA Times will have to fire 50 people one month and 80 people the next month. And no one will say, maybe we shouldn't have gone this anti-objectivity route.
Can we clarify, when you say objectivity, do you mean like that they're actually going to try and figure out exactly what happened in a way that, like, you know, in Marvel Comics, the Watcher, the big bald guy in the toga, will be like, yes, this is what objectively happened? Or is it more that they're going to be upfront about their pre-commitments and things like that and kind of be fair, but not necessarily coming from an objective point of view?
So the way objectivity used to be defined, and David Greenberg wrote a really good piece about this, was probably unrealistic, and it harkens back to the 1910s and 20s where there was a scientific revolution and we really thought that facts could be tested like beakers in a lab. But what it came to mean, like many phrases or words come to mean a cousin of its original intent, is something like being in touch with your own biases and having a North Star of not going into the story knowing beforehand who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, and what the truth is. So that's what I think the best newspapers of the 70s, 80s, and 90s did. That's what I think good outlets are doing today. And that's what I think some of the outlets that really are seeing a steep decline in readership consciously tried to get away from.
Do you, some people who talk about the demise of the great daily newspaper, and like the LA Times, even more than the New York Times, had 110% market share in the LA, greater LA area. And it's
which
nothing.
Means that more people subscribe, more newspapers were delivered than people existed in the area.
Basically. Yeah. And I mean, it was a money making, just machine. You couldn't screw this up. That is no longer the case. A lot of people will say, well, like the economics of publishing change, where, it isn't the content. It is, these fixed costs because of labor contracts and because of paper, et cetera. Do you think that is true, or is that masking this ideological caper that you think happened?
My thesis would be great if I said, no, it's all the ideology. You're right. It's much more that the only place that you could tell people you were selling a car were the want ads. That is 80% of the decline. And once Craigslist and other more efficient ways to advertise existed, the newspapers were gutted and they got rid of City Hall coverage.
They didn't adapt, right? Because they were slow-moving beasts evolved to be really kind of smug and self-satisfied.
Right. I mean, once generations of leadership tell themselves, and it's true, all we are is a license to print money, it's hard to get away from that mindset or have the people in there telling you how to pivot. Yeah.
Is there...
Nick. Yeah. But let me also say, I was talking to Ben Smith, who edits Semaphore, and he's trying to make money, but he's also trying to be a bit of a corrective to this. And I asked him, right now, Politico or The Washington Post, which is the more important publication? He says, it's no question, Politico.
Right.
Now, I don't know if you'd say Politico is the most objective newspaper or outlet, but what they're doing is understanding where the market is and addressing a need more or less without going in with good guys and bad guys narrative. And The Washington Post isn't. And so even though the entire economics of newspapers have changed, there is a way to make a lot of money doing essentially what the Washington Post should be doing.
Yeah, and the Washington Post tried to do that. They brought in a lot of non-traditional journalists who had built up blogging audiences and things like that, but they haven't quite made it gel yet. It seems to be sliding into oblivion.
To talk about a friend of mine, Dave Weigel, writes for the Washington Post, Dave essentially Weigel, gets beaten around the head and neck.
Was his first big job was at Reason Magazine.
It makes sense. And I'm not going to say he's driven out of the Washington Post, but he says, this is not the culture for me. And he goes to Semaphore.
Yeah. We lose something when we, you know, the great era of daily newspapers, you know, that mattered, and that, you know, fat phone book every Sunday showing up wrapped in like 50 pages of comics. I mean, who here misses Broomhilda like I do, or High and Lois in color, you know, on the
Boner's
weekend?
Boner's Ark, yeah, remember that one?
It's like, you know,
days.
But, you know, there's something that's lost by that. But are we in a better place from a journalistic point of view, in terms of like, okay, the journalists who are working today are better, but also as an audience, are we better served by having fewer, you know, kind of aircraft carriers that are telling us what to believe, and more, I am illiterate about the Navy, I'm innumerate about the Navy, I don't know what, you know, but is it better to have a lot of smaller institutions that are each kind of casting their own light and carving out their own path towards truth or meaning or objectivity?
But Nick, I think the battleships and cruisers have taken on holes in their hull. I'm just trying to meet you where you are on the analogy.
This is bad. This is a Sophie's Choice metaphor that I should have strangled in the bed.
I think that we're not better off. And I don't think it's necessarily because we were better off when there were Goliaths striding the earth and now that a thousand flowers should bloom. I think it's for a lot of reasons, and the fact that our attention is so attenuated and we're in the attention economy. But the public was better informed when there were more recognized gatekeepers and when there was more of an idea of shared truth. And the shared truth wasn't always right, and you could criticize it with whose objectivity, but you know, more or less we decided, well, this objectivity, this objective description of the world where gravity applies.
Let's put a concrete example out there to talk about this. Was it a better world when we were told and kind of believed that, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened? And it's like, oh, well, you know, Walter Cronkite or some other jagoff said it.
Yeah.
So we all will act as if it's true. Are we really better off in that world than in a world where we say, I don't believe virtually anything that's coming from a major media source or a major government source?
Well, to speak of the Maddox and the Turner Joy, which were these craft, let's talk Navy, that were in the Gulf of Tonkin. We're actually not sure to this day what happened. Mm-hmm. But I think there was probably a time where we could have stood athwart the drums to war in Vietnam. And Walter Cronkite saying the war is over got us out of that war.
No, it didn't. That is wrong. Joseph W. Campbell's Media Myths has documented this. By the time Cronkite said that, he was the last guy to say that. It was already over.
Okay, so he's the media member who's the last helicopter flying out of Saigon. But the point is that we can say, and we can point to that, and something happened. There was someone or a force within our society with enough authority to make that true. And I don't know, let's apply that to Afghanistan. We're in there for so many years longer. Right. And I think if we had a shared definition of truth or gatekeepers, we might not be.
But we did when we got into places like Afghanistan and certainly Iraq. And it was the New York Times and the Washington Post and all of these legendary storied institutions, right? That were like, no, we've been told by very good sources. We're not going to tell you who they are, but they, you know, there are all of the weapons of mass destruction you can imagine. Someone buried somewhere in Iraq, and it turned out not to be true.
Right. But by the same token, are we so much better off when it comes to the war in Ukraine? I mean, we haven't gone in there, but do you feel that we're getting because we have better, more varied sources, do you think we're getting a better picture of Ukraine than we were of Iraq? Maybe not before we went in. And when, by the way, Saddam Hussein actually thought he had weapons of mass destruction. So it wasn't just the New York Times thinking this. It was Saddam himself who his staff convinced. At some point, and it wasn't too far into the war, our media, when we were more gatekeepery, was able to say, this is not going well.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we're at that place now.
Yeah, I you know, I guess my response to that is partly reality is really complicated, right?
Yeah,
so maybe there is not a clear thing of what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Gaza, what's going on, you know, in Staten Island. But we're probably better off when, I mean, I would think when we don't take one view as authoritative until it has proven that it actually is really on target.
We shouldn't have a monoculture. We shouldn't have one view. Then we're living in a dictatorship. But we should have authoritative voices that mm-hmm. have the institutional history where we could say they're trustworthy. And sometimes they're going to be wrong. But now it seems we have nothing. Now it seems that anything is possible and nothing is real, to quote the title of that book about Putin's Russia. And now we have, I mean, it's definitely true when we had gatekeepers. There might be one or two flat earthers in the community, but they didn't know who each other were. And now the flat earthers become the anti-Semites, become QAnon, and that wouldn't happen in an era of gatekeepers and authority.
Yeah, this is, you know, definitely a conflict of visions, I would say, because I, you know, never having had access to these institutions as an employee, and not particularly caring for them as a consumer. I'm like, I like this world we're in now where it's much more multivocal and where you have to earn your trust and your reputation. And, you know,
Do you think we do? Do you think those who are most paid attention to have earned trust? Do you think Tim Pool does? And do you think Benny Johnson has earned the trust?
Well, you know what? Like they, you know, and let's get to talking about misinformation, malinformation, disinformation in a second. But Reason has been around since 1968. And, you know, we have earned a reputation for being biased because we're a small L libertarian. We believe in free minds and free markets, but we're kind of straight shooters and we cop to our mistakes and things like that. I think there's a lot of other organizations that do things at a higher level. Somebody like Nate Silver is a good example. He's probably more authoritative as an independent than he was when he was working for Disney, ABC News, or the New York Times, right? Because he doesn't have a big institution behind him, he's got to earn his readers' respect.
I think had he not been at the New York Times, he wouldn't be the Nate Silver we know today. I mean, maybe he'd be making more money playing poker. Yeah. But so Reason started in what year?
68.
Was Reason back then when there were gatekeepers, was it less paid attention to?
Obviously, yeah. But it was also because distribution was so much harder. I mean, this is... you know, we, like many smaller publications, you know, really were able to grow leaps and bounds in the 90s when the cost of distributing information became much cheaper, which also means a lot of bad stuff can come in. But, you know, when the barriers to entry are lower, but also you can start to earn out, you know, what you're worth.
Yeah. So my thesis with Reason is that it's credibility and impact throughout the years doesn't tell you much about gatekeepers because you were extremely impactful and credible back in the late 90s and early 2000s when there were still essentially gatekeepers, when Tim Pool and QAnon didn't have 10 or 15% of mind share and market share. That's what I would say.
All right. You know, there's a lot of bizarre publications always. And in the 90s, you know, Jerry Falwell was literally, you can look it up, Google or go to YouTube. He was selling videos called the Clinton Chronicles, where he was talking about all the bodies were piling up in Mena, Arkansas, at the airstrip where Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton were killing people while bringing in marijuana and cocaine from overseas.
Right.
That was Jerry Falwell, you know, the moral majority. So, I mean, fringe beliefs, you know, or alternative beliefs always flourish in American culture.
Were they that impactful as they are today?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
they didn't make their way into presidential races.
Something like the great self-published book, A Texan Looks at Lyndon, which came out in the mid-60s and was this incredible attack on Lyndon B. Johnson, which Robert Caro is writing up, you know, in three volumes and getting Pulitzer Prizes for. All he's doing is elaborating the, you know, calumnies that are in that book that sold millions of copies. I don't know if it was impactful or not, but it was out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's always those voices out there.
Mm-hmm. I do remember, was it the Arkansas Project and
the American Spectator.
Right, yeah. The effort to sully Clinton, and it had some impact. And maybe you would say, too bad it didn't have a bigger impact.
No, actually, I mean, what the American Spectator is interesting because it's still around, also a publication that I think started in 1967. And it is the place where Malcolm Gladwell got his journalistic start. Doesn't talk about it that often, but it was in Indiana University that I moved to D.C. They lost the following they had because then they went from reporting stories about Clinton using state troopers for all kinds of ill things to talking about how he cheated at golf. And, you know, that he would give his used underwear to charity and take a tax deduction for like $6 a pair or something. Right. Like it devolved into silliness, right? And now nobody reads the American Spectator anymore. So that's kind of a good thing, right?
That is a good thing. But I think if the Spectator and that what was animating them, you take that and you put that in 2024, it would gain much more wide purchase.
Well, let's talk about, because you've written about and you've talked about things like misinformation and disinformation. But, you know, talking about somebody like Tim Pool, who does Timcasts for the people who he's a very popular YouTube podcaster. Mostly always wears a beanie. That's his thing. He looks like he's from Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids.
Hey.
Something, right? And but he was named along with Benny Johnson, who had been at BuzzFeed News and is now at Turning Point USA, a fabulist and plagiarist, and a couple of other
Dave
people.
Dave Rubin was the other prominent one, right?
Have been outed as having received money from a fake organization that was funneling, or it's alleged that they were funneling money from the Russian government and RT, a government, a state-owned media operation, to these American influencers to kind of spread pro-Russian narratives in the news, right?
Yeah.
Where do you go with that?
Well, what Poole did today and what all of the prominent ones, there are a couple others with the organization, they claim to be victims. And there is no proof, and I am willing to believe they stated their actual honest opinions, even though I think quite often inaccurate opinions. And the Russians like this, and so the Russians essentially paid them money in a distribution deal, a company called Tenet. And that might be true. I think that probably is true. It's also the fact that I've seen people saying, oh, it's always Russia, Russia, Russia.
Right.
It's quite clear that Iran is anti-Donald Trump and was trying to get a dossier out. So there really is a lot of attempts to misinform and disinform the public.
Right.
I don't think there's not been proof that they've really gone anywhere, but we should pay attention to this. The question is, what do we do about it? Now, I came to the conclusion that for many years, probably like all of you, I was pretty shocked at the attempts of the Russians to influence the election after the 2016 election. Right.
Yeah.
Afterwards, details would come out. It seemed they were trying. I think they probably had a trivial impact, though when the vote is that close, you can't say it didn't sway enough people to have a real effect. But I also think, so where I came
although in— Although all of the big reports
have
said, like, it clearly did not change the outcome.
I think the best report on this is an NYU report, and that is true. But when votes are so close, you could never tell.
Okay.
And it does seem that the Russians spent a lot of money on stupid things, like trying to influence the vote in Idaho. But, so I came to the conclusion, first I was of the mindset, disinformation is going on, and my hair isn't on fire about it, but if you can protect America and the body politic, you should probably or definitely not by making government do anything, just by encouraging the social media platforms to see what's in their own best interest. But then over time, I saw so many examples of people claiming disinformation or reporters on the disinformation beat. Ben Collins, formerly of MSNBC, he now runs The Onion. He was the worst offender.
And to his credit, he is destroying The Onion as well.
Oh, that's so. So the consistency is something to really tip your hat to. So I saw so many people claiming disinformation or citing disinformation, and all that was information I don't like. And right. I remember watching a hearing where Matt Taibbi was in front of Congress, and Michael Schellenberger was there too, and Representative Goodman, no, the representative who was one of the who ran one of the impeachment inquiries, started talking about the New York Post Hunter Biden laptop story. And he started saying that it was not true. What the New York Post reported was not true. And he was misquoting the New York Post in an effort to show what disinformation was. He was literally engaging in disinformation. So I said, we have to stop this. And so I was very sympathetic to the Taibbi Schellenberger way of looking at this, that it all it becomes is a cudgel to silence our critics. And yet now, I think there's a bit of going overboard. And I just interviewed Renee DiResta, who used to be with the Stanford Internet Observatory. And
And can you explain what that was?
They were an organization that worked with a couple other universities and a nonprofit, and they did get a grant from the government. But they would try to chronicle what the misinformation was, both during the election and about COVID. So the idea would be like, a year later, 2 years later, we could point to this is how many people saw these tweets that talked about Sharpies being used on ballots and they weren't true. Mm-hmm. So at least we get an idea of how big the reach was. I think we need to do that. So I'm glad they were doing that. As part of what they were doing, they also had undergraduates overseen by graduates and DiResta herself at times raise these issues to the social media platforms themselves. So you have a watchdog also being a bit of a hall monitor.
Right.
And a couple of times they flagged tweets that were criticized as not being disinformation. Mm-hmm. I read the entire report put forward by Jim Jordan and the Republicans in the Judiciary Committee. And what I wanted in preparation for my interview with DiResta, what I wanted to know was, give me a précis, give me 10 bullet points of the worst tweets, the worst examples where Stanford said, this is disinformation, and it turned out to be true. And I got to tell you, there was nothing there. It was an embarrassing report, and not because I'm against Jim Jordan. It was, they just didn't have the goods. There was one or two things that I more or less agreed with, which is Newt Gingrich criticizing Pennsylvania trying to rewrite election laws, which I think Newt Gingrich was wrong, but my point is that a politician should be allowed to engage in this. So in summary, Stanford was more or less doing what a university should do and what we as the public should want, chronicling the extent of disinformation. Michael Schellenberger, I'm not going to blame Taibbi that much, all he talks about is how Renee DiResta is a CIA plant because she interned at the CIA when she was an undergraduate. He engages in so much innuendo, trying to raise the specter that she's working at the behest of the CIA. And they canceled the Stanford Internet Observatory. You know, they're now only looking into, I guess, kiddie porn or essentially. And my point is that even though I am foursquare against saying that this is disinformation, just using that as a means to get your own political project across, I do think that there's been an pendulum have swung the other way and she has been smeared.
What do you think about things that came out of, and obviously Schellenberger and Taibbi reported on this, but the Twitter files, as well as Reasons, Robbie Suave looked, he got a tranche of documents from Facebook where you see government officials saying, stop this or shut this down, et cetera, in the name of disinformation, the name of misinformation. Is that okay, or should it be non-profit, non-governmental entities that are acting as a media watchdog?
If it is, it depends to a large degree if it really is disinformation or if it is information
What do we mean when we say disinformation?
Well, one example where they tried to silence speech was Jay Bhattacharya and and his efforts to talk about mitigation techniques with COVID. Right. And the silencers were wrong, and they really did suppress his speech, and that is wrong. On the other hand,
with the Hunter Biden story, right? Everybody was told, like, this is fake, this is Russian disinformation. The New York Post story is objectively wrong, and it turned out not to be.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. It's been Hunter Biden, the day we're talking, just pled guilty to crimes that were at least mentioned or hinted at in the laptop. So yeah, that definitely is wrong. I'm very against the government being involved. If you talk about public entities, government boards, working with private entities to in good faith raise issues of you're misinforming the public about vaccine examples where vaccines aren't safe or vaccines will kill you, that's for a public good. That is the public good. So I do think there's a balance to be struck, but like you, like I think a lot of the people here, I'm really, really worried about, I'm more worried about censorship than about some examples of misinformation getting it wrong.
And I mean, you certainly believe in a marketplace of ideas, so that if Twitter is going to go on some kind of weird Elon bender where it's like he's not going to allow certain people to speak or speak as freely, then people will go to some other platform, or we should talk about that rather than force him or anybody else to say something they don't believe or not to, or to censor something.
Because I believe in the marketplace of ideas.
So
exactly.
Let's talk, you know, you mentioned early on that you are part Italian and part Jewish. October 7th seemed to be a reckoning point. You're also a kind of conventional liberal, right? Modern liberal?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think so.
Was October 7th and the not the attacks themselves, but the response in America to the Hamas attacks in Israel, was that a moment for you, it seems like among a lot of liberals, where that kind of put the brakes on going along with very ultra woke progressive ideals about, okay, you know what, our society is sick or twisted, or identity is so important that we have to subordinate other issues to this larger goal. And then suddenly, you know, something like, well, I'm not going to go with you to say, to celebrate what Hamas did, and I'm going to be more of a traditional liberal.
So it definitely didn't change my mind, because my mindset was exactly where you're talking about beforehand. What it did is give just another example of, I'm going to fault myself for thinking back in 2014 or 2015, there'd be articles about, say, the excesses on campus, or there'd be an article about, you know, Seattle City Council would have some sort of speech code. And I would not think, oh, this isn't happening, but I would think it was the exception. I would think that Breitbart, which is the same publication with a black crime vertical, by pointing to this, doesn't have the most credibility. But then I began to see and experience this actually is happening a lot. And then another story that we told ourselves, which is when these campus kids get into the workplace will correct that. That turned out to be untrue. So there was a march more and more about these ideas of thought codes or wrong think, or how much acceptability we give to literal terrorist organizations. Probably 10 years ago, I would say there is no way that a Hamas-type organization would ever be allowed to fly a flag in the United States. We'd all come down on that. No different from if someone started talking on behalf of Al-Qaeda on September 30th, 2001. Mm-hmm. But now we see that's not true. I went on a trip to Israel about a month after the attacks, and I met with people from who were formerly in the Shin Bet and formerly in the highest reaches of government. And I'm not going to say it changed my mind, but it clarified to me everything that if I was thinking it or suspecting it was true, it proved to me that this was, I don't know if you want to say a time for choosing or more black and white. I'm a big seer of nuance, but more black and white and more pressing an issue than maybe if I was at a remove and saying, well, you know, I want to be a fair-minded, objective journalist. I could still be objective, but I could still say the October 7th attacks were this horror that must be responded to.
Is there something, do you think, happening on the right? If the far left, you know, people are peeling off of that and being like, I'm going back towards the center. Is something like that overdue on the right, or is it happening where a couple days after Tucker Carlson, who, you know, went from, you know, being a Cato adjunct scholar, starting the Daily Caller, he had worked at the Weekly Standard, he was a staff writer at Talk Magazine, we're going way back now.
That was a very buzzy message.
Yeah, and then he was the biggest host on Fox News, and then now on Tucker Carlson TV or whatever it's called, the Tucker Carlson Network, TCN.
Yeah.
You know, just recently had a long, very controversial interview with a historian who was talking about how, like, yeah, you know, like Churchill is the real villain of World War II. Is that going to be that on the right, or what do you think?
I don't know. I think probably that part, the equivalent of that part, what we're seeing out of Tucker, you know, post-Bowtie Tucker, that's when it all went south for him, mm-hmm. right? What we're seeing out of him now is probably the parts on the left that won't raise the Hamas flag, but certainly mm-hmm. at least like the fact that they... that protesters defaced Union Station with anti-Israel sentiment. I was at the DNC, and one clarifying thing to me was just how few protesters there were in number, how much the Democrats ignored them, because I think going in, you would say, well, this is a large part of their constituency. Yeah. They have to give them time. They can't possibly just push them out of the convention hall. They absolutely did that. Literally, Palestinian, pro-Palestinian protesters and Palestinians themselves, and these were delegates, they did a sit-in outside the convention hall and nothing happened. The Democrats didn't pay a cost. So maybe we just think because it's on a college campus and a college that journalists want to send their kids to or they went to, maybe, or just it's exciting, you know, it's interesting, it's newsy, it's in New York City, media capital of the world. There are these things going on. But maybe we've convinced ourselves, or the media or whatever liberalism has convinced itself, that there's more of a sentiment that needs to be addressed on the anti-Israel part of the Democratic Party. And it's just not true.
Tucker Carlson, does he matter? He has probably arguably, you know, by some measures, a bigger audience now than he even had on Fox News. But, you know, does it matter that he is talking for a couple hours every day or thereabouts on Twitter? How do you gauge audience and influence in this new media scape where there are no gatekeepers?
Right. So with Tucker, I don't know. I have stronger opinions with Joe Rogan, where what I think was going on is that...
Have you been on Rogan?
I've not.
Okay. You're probably never going to be after you say whatever you're about to say.
I don't mind Rogan. Yeah. I just think he doesn't like my haircut. Mm. I think
he's
that
jealous.
I think what happened with Rogan is that he was more or less the symptom and symbol of a conversation that was going on in America, mm-hmm. and he got pointed to as the cause. And he has the most listened to podcast. Mm-hmm. Is it influential? Of course it's influential. Did more people take ivermectin than would have without him? I suppose some, but I don't think it showed up in any of the CDC data. I don't think any one person is quote unquote influential, but I do think that there's this network effect of Tucker saying something that put something into the bloodstream of the mm-hmm. right, Candace Owens kind of echoing that. And now maybe you have a few people who are more or less in agreement of, I don't know if it's going to be that Churchill was the cause of World War II or what. But yeah, it's not a good thing. No one person is as influential as Walter Cronkite, though, as you proved he's also
invariably wrong.
Yeah, well, he's also in that case with Vietnam more of the symbol than the cause.
Right. Well, let's talk about The Gist real quick. Why a daily podcast? It's like about 36 minutes, which is nice. It's snappy. You usually have a great tight interview, sometimes two parts, with a recent author or person of influence. Why should people listen to The Gist?
Oh, because I'm handsome.
Okay. That really comes through on the radio, right?
Yes.
Or on the podcast version.
The Gist is the sort of place where if you have an expansive view of what is interesting, what could be true, but also say to yourself, you know what I love more than anything else to be challenged in my preconceptions. It's a great show. If I was a listener, this is what I would want to listen to. It's anti-ideological in many ways. I will often ask questions that rebut my own ideology. I probably have more liberal people on and professors on, and then I frequently ask them questions that they never get on their book tour.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of are a ball buster. Not in a mean way. No, but like you make people kind of work for their points.
Yeah, right? That's right. Yeah. I try to. And then in my spiel, again, I have never loved the shows. I actually listen to a lot of shows that are very ideological, and here I am, and here's my opinion. So you'll get my opinion, but also my opinion will often be not this is right and this is wrong. My opinion will be here's a thing I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly what the right answer is, but I even think that thinking out loud, which has its merits, even that is harder and harder these days. So maybe I'm just trying to think out loud. I'm trying to be interesting. Sometimes I ask myself, am I too interested in that which is interesting? Yeah. Right? Do I work too hard, how I define interesting, do I work too hard to find the areas where, well, you know, I was talking to my wife about this. Did Donald Trump really say he's not going to accept the results of the election if he loses? Or did he say that he's not willing to commit to that now? And she said, what the hell are you talking about? Right. Like, he is saying bad things about the election. I'm like, you're probably right. Yeah. But I think it's more interesting to get into some of the nuances.
I want to, as a final point, and we had talked before tonight, but you mentioned you are the child of two school teachers.
That's right.
Grew up in Nassau County. But your father did something interesting, and he gave you subscriptions to National Review and the New Republic.
Right, when Buckley and Kinsley were the editors.
Talk about, you know, how did that form the way that you think about stuff and the way you do journalism?
My father was a social studies teacher, and he would always, the kids would ask, who are you voting for, Mr. Pesca? And he would never think to say who he was voting for. And I grew up thinking that was the ideal. And
it was Lyndon LaRouche.
Yeah, it was LaRouche. Yeah, he was a LaRouche man all the way through. And and he subscribed me to both these magazines, and I thought they were both excellent. And I really grew up imbibing the idea that this clash of ideas is the embodiment of the best way to think. And I guess you could say if my goal was self-preservation, it didn't serve me well when I got to Slate, right? I think the media has gone away from that. I bemoan those times. I think fantastic ideas come from all manner of places. But I credit my father and his definition of what it means to be a rigorous thinker. And I don't even know if, you know, I'm a father and I strategize sometimes. What's the best way to show this to kids? Maybe it was something about his background or being a social studies teacher, but it was just very natural for him to look at the world like that, and it became natural for me to look at the world like that. And I think maybe the world doesn't look like that anymore, so maybe that has served me, and maybe it hasn't.
Well, are you optimistic that, you know, in this, you know, multiverse of opinions and different sources and, you know, just information overload, are we closer to that than sometimes we think, or is it just that people wall out anything they don't already believe?
I think we're siloed. I think it's a big problem. I don't know that. So you should know I have anandamide, which is called the bliss molecule, so I don't really experience anxiety like a lot of other people do. So if you ask me if I'm optimistic, the answer will almost always be yes.
Okay.
But I can't swear that that is a warranted opinion. I'm just by nature optimistic. But I don't see a huge corrective or great things going on in terms of the mass of society moving back to an area where Kinsley and Buckley will be debating. What I do see is really good, robust niches and places like Substack serving a place where you can have those debates and have really interesting, kind of the old way of thinking about things where it doesn't start with the answer and then you backfill the evidence.
All right, we're going to stop there. Thank you, Mike Pesca.
Thanks.
Joining us.